You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's programme, should Hungary be expelled from the European Union because of its treatment of refugees? Also ahead,
the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that major conflict zones in Syria were calm after the ceasefire took effect at 7 p.m. on Monday.
Syria's ceasefire is holding for the moment, more or less. Could it be the first tentative sign that the civil war is entering its final phase? We'll also discuss the election of opposition MPs in Belarus, the first time it's happened in almost 20 years, and
vicious people are much more interesting than nice, good people. There's nothing more boring than a totally good person. They've got to have quirks. Bad habits. You can have a nice one as well, the chucked in there, but if you had a book full of nothing but nice people, it'd be awfully boring.
On what would have been his 100th birthday, we'll discuss the enduring appeal of arguably the greatest ever children's author, Roald Dahl. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst Stephen Dale and Nina Schick, who is an independent political consultant. Welcome both. Now, much current discourse within the EU is, of course, consumed with the logistics of reducing the membership from 28 members to 27 following the UK's vote to leave earlier this summer. There are those, however, who believe the membership should be reduced still further to 26. Luxembourg's Foreign Minister Jean Asselborn, admittedly not the heftiest heavyweight roaming the continent's corridors of power, has called for Hungary to be thrown out, citing Budapest's apparent disregard for refugees, press freedom, judicial independence, and other such niceties. Nina, first of all, Hungary, predictably, says Mr. Asselborn, and I quote, cannot be taken seriously. Should he be?
Well, he probably isn't the biggest political heavyweight on the EU scene, but it's true that there is no way to make Hungary leave. The EU is a club where people were always meant to join and no one was supposed to leave. And as we've seen from Brexit, the only way to make any member leave the club is if they choose to leave themselves.
I want to come back to that shortly, because that does seem a bizarre omission when drawing up the rules and regulations of any club. But Stephen, briefly, what is the case against Hungary, as Mr. Asselborn appears to see it?
It's the fact that they've built a rather vicious-looking fence across their along their border with Serbia, and they're refusing to allow migrants to cross into their territory, even if some of them want to cross further from that, then it's not letting them in, which Mr. Asselborn is saying is against the principles of the EU. And he's also, he accuses them of threatening to shoot some of these migrants if they try and cross. They are putting up pepper spray, and apparently there will be some armed guards or soldiers on that border. So it strikes me, and Nina knows far more about this than I do, but it strikes me just from reading the reports that whether he's trying to make Luxembourg more noticed, but he's jumping up and down and making a lot of noise. Is it really, Nina? Is he really? Is it?
Well, Orban Asselborn obviously isn't an authority, but Orban has. So basically, the EU at the height of the refugee crisis decided they would redistribute the migrants around with a mandatory quota. This was very much Merkel's brainchild after she basically suspended Dublin and said, you know, if you make it into Europe, we'll give you sanction. And the interesting thing is that In Europe, where Germany is often the key player and takes the lead, is that Orban has made a coalition of other member states, which he's kind of become the leader, which has now left Germany isolated on the refugee and migration question. And they're actually going to hold a referendum in October as to whether or not, as referendum is all the rage these days, whether or not the Hungarian people want to accept these migrant quotas. Now, in the case of Hungary, this is only 1,200 refugees that they're supposed to take into the country. And they've also launched a legal challenge against the EU at the EU's highest court to say that these quotas are illegal and should not be mandatory or binding. And the interesting thing now is that Germany is isolated and loads of other countries, including in Central and Eastern Europe, are behind Hungary on this one.
Stephen, you described Mr. Asselborn there as jumping up and down and making a lot of noise. A point I'm only following up just so I can read out some more of Hungary's responses to him, because I do so enjoy it when politicians lose their tempers with each other in public. They've described him as a frivolous character who is patronising, arrogant and frustrated, and more to the point, a classic nihilist. This is all from Hungary's Foreign Minister, Péter Szijjártó, but who goes on to make what to him, I'm sure, is a more serious point, where he does that thing that Hungary has done repeatedly of trying to cast itself as this bulwark of European values, defending the continent from the marauding hordes to the east. Leaving aside some of the more inflammatory rhetoric Hungary has deployed in that quest, do they have half a point? Has Europe forgotten itself? Is there, and this does seem to be a divide between East and West, that the East seems more keen on defending what it likes to think of as the classic European values, and does seem to regard the West as, if not actually nihilist, then certainly somewhat soft on this.
I think it's largely a question of geography. I mean, they seem to be in the front line when it comes to the refugees coming in. And they say that, those of us further west just, don't understand the situation. And of course, they're also in the position where they've come to the EU table much later, only after the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. And although, they've been welcomed in and they're very keen to be members, but, they want their voices to be heard. They don't want to be seen as, we must be seen to be grateful to be members of the EU now. So we will say yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, so we will do whatever you want. They say, we're members, and therefore we're full members, and therefore our voice has got to be listened to as well.
Nina, I do just want to return to the original point, which is the possibility or otherwise of throwing a country out of the EU, if not Hungary, for whatever it is doing or may yet do. What happens if an EU state, and this is far from impossible in the current climate, elected an absolute out-and-out fascist?
Right now, nothing happens. There's nothing they can do under legal circumstances. Nothing can happen.
Although, did nobody think of this at the time?
Well,
it's not like there are no European countries with something of a history for this kind of thing.
Well, exactly. Well, one would argue that the precise reason they founded the EU was so that this could not happen again. And this is the great irony you see in European politics right now, where you see the middle ground kind of splintering and the rise of both far right and far left parties, where this is now an actual viable proposition. But that is the political situation in which we now find ourselves.
Well, on that happy thought, we'll move on to our next subject and undertake the always fate-tempting exercise of trying to be optimistic where Syria is concerned. A ceasefire which came into effect at sunset yesterday appears to be more or less holding, with no civilian deaths reported since as we go to air. Even the primary battlefield of Aleppo is reported to be relatively quiet. It does remain to be seen, however, whether sufficient calm can be guaranteed to enable the delivery of obviously much-needed aid. Stephen, the deal is a truce for 7 days, after which there will be joint US-Russia airstrikes against Islamic State and Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, who have rebranded themselves. They were formerly the Nusra Front. US Secretary of State, who we heard at the top of the program, has called it the last chance to preserve a united Syria. Is it?
It can't be. It simply can't be the last chance to preserve United. I mean, if this one doesn't work out, they've got to try again. I followed, obviously, from the Russian side. I followed closely what was happening over the weekend and met with a certain amount of scepticism the announcement that the Russians and the Americans had, as it were, got into bed together over this one. I really think this has got to be taken, 24 hours, maybe even 12 hours at a time, maybe an hour at a time. I think it's great that they've gone 24 hours. And that is, I'm not being sarcastic, that is
no,
an achievement.
It's not like, we should stress, it's not like there hasn't been a shot fired in Syria since yesterday. There has been, but in the scheme of things, this is progress.
Yes, and if we get through 7 lots of this, and so the 7 days are completed, and actually you do see the Russians and the Americans agreeing to attack the same targets, that would be, if it happens. Huge progress.
Nina, that suggestion of explicit US-Russia cooperation, and I mean, up until now, there's clearly been some coordination to ensure that they don't shoot down each other's aircraft while they're flying around Syria, blowing up whoever it is they're blowing up. But this idea that they will actually cooperate, does that suggest that we've got to the point at which basically Russia and America and all onlookers have just decided that they're less interested in who wins this war now than they are in just the war being brought to an end?
I think that it's very interesting that we're just talking, well, obviously the US and Russia are the big players here, but if you actually look at what's going on in the ground, I think the rebels have been very critical about this truce, which has basically been brokered over their heads, and they don't believe that the government is actually going to stick to it. So I think that the best we can hope from it, if we take, I think it's a fair assessment, is that some humanitarian aid can get in. I think it's 600,000 Syrian civilians are under siege right now in 16 districts. And then, I mean, who knows what's going to happen with Russia and the US? I really don't understand, to be honest with you.
Well, they themselves said that most of the agreement would be kept secret, just in case it could be abused by other people. I mean, which suggests either that they're getting on really well, or that actually they've agreed to disagree on so much that they're not admitting it.
But do you get the sense of any overlap, I guess, in what the US and Russia see as some sort of end to this, some sort of settlement?
I honestly believe it's too early to think of an end. I don't think either side is thinking of an end. To my mind, from the Russian point of view, I think the Russians now have achieved one of their main aims. They are seen to be at the top table. They are seen to matter. You know, the Americans are sitting down with them. Whatever's happening has happened and is happening in Ukraine, the Americans are now actually talking one-to-one with them at a very high level and have come to some sort of agreement. You know, if this 7 days works out, then, you know, there will be joint military action. I mean, that is a real feather in Putin's cap. That's one up for him. He will have achieved one of his aims.
And Nina, I can't tell anymore where Syria is concerned what is actually a main plot and what is a subplot. But has Turkey's more robust intercession, do you think, focused people's attention on it a bit more closely?
On Syria?
Yeah.
Well,
or at least on the possibility of trying to find some way to bring it to some sort of end.
Well, I honestly, when it comes to Syria, nobody really knows. I honestly can't say whether or not this is really going to come to an end. I think it's interesting that Erdogan's been saying that, you know, he's going to pass on a lot of humanitarian aid. And of course, they have a lot of Syrian refugees in Turkey. But I don't have a crystal ball. I honestly don't even know. Like we were saying, I think this goes hour by hour, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Stephen, to return to that statement of Secretary of State Kerry, that it's the last chance to preserve United Syria, et cetera, et cetera. Is that actually even at this point the right goal to be pursuing? Is there any meaningful chance that 5, 10, 15 years, however long this goes on before it comes to some sort of end, this idea that Syria will somehow again be as Syria was 10 years ago, it's optimistic, isn't it?
It's highly optimistic. You know, we've mentioned Turkey as well. And if you're mentioning Turkey and you're mentioning Syria, you're talking about the Kurds as well. You know, that's another problem that is not going to go away in a hurry. Where, you know, even if peace could be brought to Damascus, then what's going on in the north of the country? It is such a... I do not pretend to be an expert on Syria, but it is all I can see. It is such a complicated situation. You know, and then you've got Daesh or so-called Islamic State. You know, you've got these other groups. You know, there's not even an opposition you can talk about. There are so many fractured groups. To talk about, you know, whether the country's going to stay in one piece geographically, I think it's much too early to.
Well, to look at it then from Russia's point of view, which is your particular area of expertise, do you get the sense that Russia has an objective in sight, that they have focused or clearly understood within themselves what it is they want from Syria eventually, when all this is over?
Peace eventually. I mean, they would, you know, they want to make sure that, you know, it's not quite on Russia's southern border, but it's not a very long way away. You know, it's close enough for them genuinely to be worried about what's going on there, and with a huge Islamic population within their own borders, and the, you know, we know there's been connections with Chechnya, connections with groups such as Daesh. They are, you know, they are very concerned. As I say, they were concerned to be on the top table. They're there, fine. That's they've got that one. But it is in their interests to make sure that some kind of peace is achieved in Syria. And actually, that is more important than keeping Assad in place. Yes, they've had a reliable ally there in Assad. And if you go back over more than 25 years, back into the Soviet times, you know, the Arab countries tended to have pretty good relations with the Soviet Union. But the Russians are very pragmatic. And if a peaceful Syria were to be achieved and had to be achieved without Assad, then I don't think that the Russians would, you know, they're not going to stand on that one endlessly and say, oh, we must have it with Assad in power. They will be talking to him behind the scenes and maybe even offering political asylum or something. But he, to them, is not an essential part of the Russian endgame.
Nina, I guess just a final thought on this. This idea of Russia having bought their way back, I think, as they would see it, to the top table through their intercession in Syria. Do you get the sense that they are actually in charge of it, though, or are they at this point the proverbial chap trying to ride a tiger?
They are in charge as anyone can be. I mean, obviously, you saw what happened as soon as the Russians got involved, you know, also with regards to the effect on Europe. You know, a lot of people thought that Russia was bombing the civilian targets so that more refugees would come over to Europe. But prior to their involvement, nobody was talking to them. This was, you know, just after Ukraine had happened. No, they were blacklisted, you know, shunned from the international stage. We remember what Obama was saying about Putin, and then, you know,
and they suddenly, it's a year now, it's September last year, they suddenly burst on the scene. Suddenly they're carrying out airstrikes. I mean, it really did come as a bolt from the blue.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and it's taken a year, but they have achieved one of their aims.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Nina Schick and Stephen Dl. Coming up, why has Belarus's opposition won its first seats in the country for 20 years? Do stay tuned.
Trump or Clinton? Clinton or Trump? If, like me, you're not American, you don't get a vote. But that doesn't mean we won't be affected. Welcome to the global election.
America is critical to the maintenance of peace and security in the world, not least because of what it stands for as a democratic nation, a guardian of freedom and the values of democratic nations.
From war and peace to the economy and the environment, what happens in America has an impact on us all. A large part of that is influenced by the president, whoever he or she may be. So in the run-up to November's vote, join me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24, as we look at what this election will mean for the rest of the world. That's the global election with Steve Bloomfield, coming soon to Monocle 24.
Tall Stories is a new 5-minute audio snack from the team who bring you The Urbanist each week. In just a few minutes, we talk about one building, one statue, one park bench that has an interesting backstory, something special to reveal to us about life in the city in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes we'll get all historical on you, other times we might be yearning for modernity, but it's 5 minutes of urban diversion, an unplanned journey down the secret side streets of metropolitan life that will, we hope, keep you intrigued. Available every Monday, you can get it by subscribing to The Urbanist via Monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. Be a part of the story.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, still with me, and Nina Schick and Stephen Dl. Now, we don't usually spend a lot of time dissecting the results of elections in Belarus. They do tend towards the somewhat predictable, almost as if the country's pretensions to democracy are some sort of shabby hollow mockery. Excitingly, however, or possibly mistakenly, it appears that in Sunday's parliamentary election, the opposition may have won a seat. The lucky MP is Anna Kanopetskaya of the United Civil Party, although it does seem likely that she will face a chamber otherwise overwhelmingly loyal to the indefatigable quasi-tyrant Alexander Lukashenko. Rumours do suggest, as we go to air, that another independent MP may also have been elected. This is exciting, a Belarusian spring. Nina, how big a deal actually is this?
Well, it's two, potentially two seats. So I don't know if it's really that big of a deal, but it is a sign of perhaps Belarus thawing a little bit to the West. They've traditionally always stuck very close to Russia. And Lukashenko lost, after he won, of course, another landslide victory last October, he actually freed a lot of political prisoners, which led to the EU lifting sanctions. And one could argue that this has potentially this is the beginning of a tangent whereby Belarus is trying for its own economic reasons to try and build some kind of closer relations to the West because the Russian economy is suffering.
This is the interesting question, of course, as to what it all actually means. Stephen, do you get the idea or the impression that a concession of this sort may have been decided in advance?
In Belarus?
In Belarus, yeah. In permitting the election of opposition or independent MPs.
I don't think it's exactly a victory for democracy. So, yes, I think that there is, you know, there has been something in the background, and they're delighted that the West is picking this up and saying, oh, look, one, maybe even two opposition MPs in a house of 110. So they won't have a particularly loud voice. But I think that Nina's point about the Russian economy, that Belarus, let's face it, is almost a part of Russia still, almost. I say, well, you know, it is, yes, it's an independent country, but it's still...
That can be fixed.
And it's still very tied to its Soviet past. I mean, one of the things Lukashenko did was bring back the old Soviet era Belarusian flag. They are very close to the Russians, and they're also very dependent. Their economy is very dependent on Russia. Now, Russia's economy is not in a good way. Even Russian officials are saying that the money in the bank, which a few years ago was $150 billion, may run out next year. And that's largely the oil price. It's also sanctions. But those two things, they have hit hard. And so, although Belarus, Lukashenko is tied very closely to Russia, you know, they're thinking, well, actually, you know, we could do with other economic links, because if the Russian economy really were to go into serious decline, then that directly hits Belarus. So although Lukashenko has been very proud of the fact that he, as he sees it, he's one, been very independent to anyone, any outside influence, and two, very popular in his own country, apparently, all these elections he's won, five of them in a row. It may look as if actually having some friends elsewhere is a good idea. So seeing first of all, actually more important, I think, than these opposition MPs being elected was the lifting of sanctions that Nina mentioned, that the EU lifted these sanctions, because that means at least they can trade more freely with the West. So that's a good start. And this is another little step in the right direction, shall we say.
It's a difficult balance for him, though, isn't it, Nina? He only needs to look as far as Ukraine to see what can go wrong if Moscow thinks you're trying to orient yourself westward with undue haste. How does he maintain that balance? I mean, Russia is obviously always going to be a fact of life for Belarus. It's right there. How does he manage that?
Well, I think that he is managing that. It's quite, this is, you know, two MPs perhaps, and, you know, the lifting of the EU sanctions. He hasn't gone where Ukraine went, which was that they tried to sign that association agreement with the EU, and that's when it really kicked off with Russia and Ukraine. At the time, Russia was trying to get Ukraine to sign a trade agreement with the Russian customs union. So I think he would not make that mistake.
Because there was part of me, I was going to ask you both a brilliantly incisive question about whether the EU was somehow preparing for life beyond Lukashenko, and maybe Belarus was as well. And then, of course, he's only 62. People forget this. It's just that he has been president since
22 years.
Yes, yeah, since the earth cooled.
Yes.
Basically, it is extraordinary. We should move on finally tonight to a happy 100th birthday to one of the best loved and indeed best selling children's authors of all time. Roald Dahl is not with us to celebrate. He died in 1990, age 74, but his books continue to sell, more than 200 million of them in at least 50 languages at last count. And across the UK today, school children are dressing up as their favourite characters from his books. It would be nice to think at least one kid out there is tempting expulsion by going to class as Uncle Oswald from Switch Bitch, because among the details of Dahl's life and works often forgotten is a canon of books very much not for children. But Nina, it's the children's books everybody knows and everybody loves, and quite rightly. But their endurance and their resonance is extraordinary. What is it about them? I mean, people try to write children's books. It's really hard to do well and really hard to do successfully. How did he do it?
What a man, and what an interesting life. I mean, that must have something to do with it. He was clearly a brilliant, brilliant mind and a real adventurer and explorer. And you just need to read some of his the books about his life and what he did and how he lived. You know, he was a spy, he was an RAF pilot, and you can then see perhaps like what an interesting life he had and how that imagination became vivid in his books for children. But I think some of his adult writings are also very, very fascinating and excellent.
They are. But Stephen, there is a question about Roald Dahl, which I suspect is going to recur more and more as the online world becomes ever more febrile and easily offended. He was an unregenerate anti-Semite. There is no getting around this at all. Should we adjust our affection for his works because of that?
That to me is the eternal question. Do you judge the past by the standards of the present day?
He was an unregenerate anti-Semite really pretty recently.
But does that mean we don't read his books? When, as you say, 200 million of them have been printed and read. To be honest, that wasn't when I was reading these to my own children and indeed watching on, there was a television series called Tales of the Unexpected back in the 70s
here
in
Britain. That was fantastic.
And those were some of his darker adult tales. It wasn't a question, I have to admit, that I asked myself.
See, I've always thought that you can't judge the art by the artist, as it were. That's a fairly basic category error that gets you into all sorts of trouble reasonably quickly. But Nina, is it something you can just put to one side entirely, especially if you're sort of reading this stuff to the kids?
Probably not. But to be honest with you, I think his legend is such that people would still continue reading his works. But to be honest with you, I didn't actually know about his anti-Semitic views. So that's news to me.
He was actually quite nasty to a lot of people as well. And that's another thing that has come out.
I think that's why that's my pet theory as to why his books work, because most stuff you get confronted with as a child is terribly cuddly and fluffy, and his books are not.
And that was
the great genius behind Gene Wilder's reading of Willy Wonka, that his Willy Wonka also came across as quite angry, vindictive, sarcastic, and at times outright unpleasant.
Indeed, and that quotation at the top of the program from Roald Dahl himself saying, nice people are all terribly well, but it's all terribly boring. And, Trunchbull in Matilda, the headmistress, I mean, we love her and hate her at the same time, but she's a character that really gets us going. It's the colour and the life he puts into those characters in the books that I think whatever he might have been like as an individual, they will still be read and they will still be enjoyed.
Just quickly, both before you go, I do have to ask you each if you have a particular favourite book and or character. Nina?
James and the Giant Peach. It's my favourite.
Interesting choice. Any particular reason?
I just loved it as a child. And Fantastic Mr. Fox, that was also a good one.
See, Fantastic Mr. Fox would have got my vote. I liked Fantastic Mr. Fox. Stephen?
Funnily enough, Matilda. I just think, I feel so sorry for this poor little girl. And I think, yes, the fact that she wins in the end and, the Trunchbull is defeated and it's all, that almost becomes cuddly because it's all sort of so sentimental. You're almost wiping a tear away at the end. And there's the lovely teacher whose name I can't remember in the
story. Miss Honey.
Miss Honey, yes. Then there's the baddies who get chased out. I just think you've got so many characters in that. And actually, there is a moral. There is a moral that for children who, even if they come from not very good backgrounds, they can still, they work hard, they can get somewhere. And that can happen.
Stephen Deal and Nina Schick, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Henry Rhys Sheridan has a special report from Oslo in Section D at 1900, and I'll have more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.